got a troubled mind. Wash it out and hang it up on a clothing line, and the sun will shine.
Hey everybody, welcome to the Science Facts and Fallacies podcast brought to you by the Genetic Literacy Project. I'm your host, Cameron English.
And I'm your co-host, Kevin Fulta, a professor who cares about science communication.
This is the weekly show where we discuss the biggest stories from the Genetic Literacy Project to keep you informed about groundbreaking developments from the worlds of science and medicine, and of course, to help you separate facts from fallacies as you read the headlines. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the show. Cameron and Kevin here as always. Kevin, what's going on?
Oh, nothing much. Just down in the land of beautiful sunshine and wonderful days where it's finally days are getting a little shorter and a little cooler here in Florida. And awfully nice to be here for the next 9 months.
Yeah, it's very exciting. The smoke has almost cleared from the sky above my house because we've got these gnarly wildfires going on in California. So hopefully they'll have them under control soon. They are making some progress. So
is it
fingers
really
crossed.
Bad? But is it really bad by you in terms of air quality and visibility?
It goes up and down. I think we're doing okay because we're not really that close to the fires. I think the nearest one's like 2 hours away. So obviously the closer you get, the worse it is, I think, generally. But it's livable, but it's noticeable. You know, you can see the orange sunset and in the evening and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, heart goes out to those folks. I mean, it's amazing how massive these fires are and how it's changing lives of so many people. And, you know, we live in the world of natural disasters down here in Florida with hurricanes, but I think I would take a hurricane over a wildfire any day. So, so many people affected this year, all up and down the West Coast and all throughout the western half of the country. So, you know, hats off to them and hopes for better times ahead.
Yeah, our thoughts and prayers for sure. But let's give some people a little bit of a distraction for the next half hour or so. So we'll dive into these stories. So first up, we're talking about a vaccine for several cancers that has made it to the next stage of clinical trials. We're going to dive into how it works and how it's made and why it's better than the previous version of the same vaccine. Next up, the public is confused and misinformed about the risks and benefits of human gene editing. We're going to look at a controversial survey that, according to some people, was misleading, but we're going to dive into the issues really behind the survey. And then finally, can gene-edited crops be detected? The environmental group Greenpeace says yes, most experts say no, and we're going to discuss why that back and forth is significant. So first up, Kevin, this cancer vaccine, this is an incredible field of research. So tell us about this story.
Oh, I love this stuff. This is an article called Vaccine Advances for Gastric, Pancreatic, Esophageal, and Colon Cancer from Genetic Engineering and Biotechnology News from last week. And what this talks about is a form of immunotherapy. And immunotherapy is these really cool techniques of using the viruses. So like herpes virus, polio virus, all these viruses that were really gnarly in exploiting their ability to infect cells, but disarm them in terms of their pathogenicity, but arm them with new information that allows them to fight cancer. And this is what's so cool. So why bother? Okay, well, colon cancer and other types of adenocarcinomas, these are digestive system cancers. They affect something like 500,000 patients a year, people who die from it. It's the third most frequent cause of cancer in the U.S., second leading cause of cancer mortality in the U.S. I've got polyps, last time I checked. I'm due for another one. But anyway, the idea is, this is really common stuff. And you know, I don't mean to make light of it because, you know, colon cancer is one of these things. There was the Black Panther guy. I can't think of his name.
I know who you're talking about. But
yeah, but he's got kind of a fancy name, like, you know, Benjamin Cumberbund or something. I can't remember. It's a really long name. It's a little bit unusual. But anyway, he recently succumbed to colon cancer at the age of 43 or something. You know, this is a real important cancer to study because if you catch it early, it can be solved. And the vaccine is another tool in that fight. So the researchers use adenovirus to induce an immune response against something called guanylyl cyclase C. And guanylyl cyclase C is a digestive epithelial specific protein, but present in like 100% of colorectal carcinomas. So this is a cancer specific signature. And so what they do is they get the virus to infect you and express the virus specific signature that then tells the body to attack the cancer cell. Okay, so that's how that works.
So in the previous iteration of this vaccine, I believe if I read that paper correctly, they would give an animal the vaccine and then their immune system would clear it immediately. So it couldn't have the intended effect. So can you speak to the changes they made to make it more effective? And I think it went from like 50 to 90% in terms of effectiveness at preventing a tumor from developing.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And that's because adenoviruses are common cold viruses. So people already have existing antibodies that clear the virus. And so if you really want it to act, you have to give the vector, okay? So the delivery system, it has to be a little bit incognito. It has to do something a little bit different. And that's what these researchers did. They started to do something with a chimeric adenoviral vector that was using a rare adenovirus serotype. So some type of adenovirus, which the body was not continually bombarded with or less likely to have seen. And so this way, you're able to do this little bit of a tweak to that virus to make it a better vehicle for delivering the antigen or the antibody or the antigen of guanylyl cyclase C to invoke an antibody response against this tumor-specific protein. So, you know, I know that's kind of confusing, but that's the trick.
Okay. So it's just a version of the virus that your immune system doesn't recognize effectively, to put it in maybe the simplest terms we can.
Yeah, that's the easy way to put it. And, okay. And the best part is there's no toxicity to non-tumor tissue. It worked beautiful in the mice models so that the virus was doing what it was supposed to do to express this guanylyl cyclase C antigen. And as you mentioned, 90% of patients were developing an immune response. And this is huge for anybody who has already been through colorectal cancer or other type of digestive cancers, because the feeling of this research team is that this will work very well in prevention of reoccurrence. And that may be the best way to think about it. So that's currently who they're testing. People who've already been cleared by chemotherapy or radiation and now are monitoring for instance of reoccurrence in this phase two trial. So looks optimistic.
And this may be sort of a dumb guy question, so correct me if I'm wrong. Because the vaccine works obviously by preventing the reoccurrence of the disease, if you're measuring it in a clinical trial, how do you gauge its efficacy if you're looking for the absence of something? Does that make sense?
Well, I think this is a lot like the trials of vaccines for coronavirus. What they're looking at are the high-risk populations in this case, the people who've already had some sort of who are in remission, people who have been cleared of the cancer. They are at a higher risk than the normal population to redevelop that cancer. And so by looking at that population, and I don't remember the size of the pool they're looking at, but it's not that huge. It's something like 100 patients. But they're gastric, pancreatic, esophageal cancers. And what they're saying is that their first-line therapies, so all of the radiation therapy, surgery, chemotherapy, whatever that was, they've been essentially cured of the disease. There's no immediate evidence of the disease. Yet they're at a high likelihood to reoccur because for whatever genetic reason, you know, these folks were predisposed, but they also might have some cells banging around that could potentially become problematic going forward. This is why they're a good population to work in. And so that's why they're being monitored for neoplasia in response to a group with and without that vaccine. So we'll see how that goes.
Okay, so final question then. How many people who are anti-GMO will take this vaccine without thinking twice about it?
Every single one of them. because you know, this, I mean, this is the kind of thing that immunotherapy has been extremely well received, because this is almost a miracle that this works. It's the emotions attached to this are very positive. You're helping people who would be committed to a terminal death sentence survive. And that kind of communication with the emotional center in a very positive way works the same way that the fearful messages about food and agriculture will work in the other way. So I think they'll be lining up for the shot and rolling up their sleeves in the event that they were to unfortunately experience these kinds of diseases.
Absolutely. Yeah, we want to help as many people as we can. Okay, so moving on, let's talk about, I guess it's called germline editing. I think human gene editing is a bit too broad. So tell us about this.
Well, when they say germline editing, they're meaning, and this is from an article by Pete Shanks from Genetics and Society from this last week. And the question really was based upon a article that was published by a guy named Dr. Christopher Geingel, and he's at University of Melbourne, and he published an article that said genetics experience impacts attitudes towards germline gene editing, their survey of 1,500 members of the public. And so he's an ethicist who has looked at gene editing in different ways and public acceptance, that kind of thing. And he asked questions of 1,500 members of the public and found a couple of interesting trends that I think are super cool. And what he basically said was that if you have good experience in gene editing, so if you understand what this is, you're more likely to be opposed to it, which I thought was surprising. And that there were other folks, like religious folks, who were more likely to be against it. So if you understood genetics and genomics, you weren't really into this. And if you were religious, you weren't into it, which I thought was really an odd time that, you know, strange bedfellows, first time, you know, those folks really connected. But other folks were seemed to be pretty good with this. And in terms of germline editing. And I really found that surprising, because I thought the people who had the greater understanding of genetics and genomics would be on board 1,000%.
And, you know, I did, that stuck out to me as well as I was looking through the survey and then looking through this article. But there's some criticism in the article. And since you're a science communications expert in many ways, tell me what you think of this. So I apparently Pete Shanks's criticism was that they primed people in the study with, I think it was like a 2-minute video about how germline editing works. And it was a very, very favorable summary of the technology and the science behind it. And so his interpretation was, well, people that know about this and know about the potential risks are a little more down on it. Whereas if you take a population of people who have no scientific background, they have maybe no direct interest because they don't have children, and then you give them, say, one side of the story, then of course they're going to have a more positive outlook on this. What do you think of that criticism?
Well, I think that's consistent with what the original paper said. And I think it was on this podcast where I said a few months ago that if I found myself on a planet surrounded by talented, smart, and beautiful gene edited people, it was a burden I could live with, you know. but bioethicists are the ultimate wet blankets. They're very concerned about the misuse of technologies, when I kind of tend to look at the sunny side of these things. And for me, I think about all the really good things you could do to eliminate diseases that we know are germline dependent, things like sickle cell anemia. You know, this week in my classes here at the university, I talked about retinoblastoma, other types of cancers that we understand where they occur genetically. You know, we're at a time where we can fix this. The doctor who fixed the twins in China that were born that will never have HIV, no matter, you know, what they do or whatever, you know, they can't have the HIV or the HIV virus, human immunodeficiency virus. So it's a really interesting question. again, more and more ethicists need to be involved. But the public needs to understand that, you know, this can be used for very good purposes. And I think the public, and that's what's so weird about all this survey, it seems like the public is on board for once, and that it's the people who are the experts that are saying proceed with caution. I thought that was kind of cool.
Yeah, that was interesting. And now that you mention it, I know there's been other survey studies like this, and there was one last year, and it got a lot of attention because I think it said the more people know about biotechnology, the less fearful they are of its use in their food, for example. But it might have been a different study, or it might have been the same one. I'm not quite sure. But the same effect didn't hold for climate change. So the more the average person learned about climatology, the more skeptical they became of, I guess, what you could call the mainstream view on climate science. And so I suppose there are just so many different factors that influence how people think about any given issue that you can't just say, we just need to give them more information. Is that a fair assessment of overall of what we can say about science communication?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, more information doesn't help anybody, at least not at the beginning. That the first connections need to be around more of the core values. And I think that's what we're seeing here. The scientists that are obsessed with the details are concerned, but the broader public that sees this is a way that we can help people overcome inherent genetic problems, you know, what's not to like? You know, previously people were committed to a life of sickle cell anemia or cystic fibrosis. And maybe we're at a time and a place where we can correct those things in a very early stage, where that nobody would ever have to suffer from them again. And I think people get that.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's funny, you mentioned retinoblastoma. My younger brother got that. It's a rare form of eye cancer. I don't know if it's rare or not. I believe it is. But at 2 years old, he had to go undergo major surgery, and they had to take out his eye because there was nothing else they could do. Mm-hmm. And so if you could prevent this at the genetic level, then, I mean, that's a game changer. And so at this point, I think because the technology is progressing so incrementally, it would be good for everyone to pay attention now, because people tend to ignore things until they become like dramatic. You know what I mean? Like the changes that you're talking about are huge. And then people go, wait, I'm not comfortable with this, but they weren't paying attention 10 years before when they could have had some influence over how the research progressed.
Wow, I didn't know that about your brother. That's pretty amazing. So it's about 1 in 18,000 live births, they say. I mean, I guess the only ones that you would count would be the live ones, but 1 in 18,000 live births. It's not completely rare, but it is relatively rare. But he went through enucleation, where they remove the eye. Is that only? But did they do both or just one?
Just one. I guess I don't know much about it, frankly. Obviously, it was very little when this happened, but.
It's interesting because he has to be very careful about his who he falls in love with, and this is why retinoblastoma was such an early cancer model. Not to divert this too much, but people learned a lot about the genetics of retinoblastoma going back into like easily in the 1500s, 1800s, because the eyes have a strange look in them, but also that people who had blindness in, say, the early 1900s until very recently, if you were blind from retinoblastoma, you were put into a school for the blind, and then you would fall in love, and then your children would have even stronger forms of retinoblastoma 25% of the time. So what this was saying was that people who had a non-penetrant form, when they got together, led to children that were completely riddled with cancer. And it's a very interesting gene, but now, you know, not to divert this too much, but really, really interesting history of what that is. But bottom line is that that's the kind of thing that could be corrected in a fertilized embryo at the 2-cell stage. I mean, how cool is that?
Yeah, it very much is groundbreaking. And that's what encourages me to keep an open mind about it. I just think people, I was trying to say this earlier, I think people, they get this vision of in their head of what might be possible in 100 years. And based on that, they say, no way, I'm not down with this. And then they forget about these small improvements that we could make in a relatively short timeline, like with the example of, of my brother with that eye cancer. You know, so you can have, in this sense, you can have your cake and eat it too, I think. You can have the treatments that are relatively safe, and once they go through clinical trials, as we've discussed before, without thinking about, well, what about the super babies we're going to build? You know, that's not quite here yet, I guess is what I'm saying.
No, you got it. Super babies are kind of BS. I mean, although it's possible and some weirdo out there might do it, you have to look at the positive things that we can do for people and the planet, particularly people who are afflicted by things we can fix. And people always ask the question, you know, just because we can, does it mean that we should? And I say, yes. You know, especially in the areas where we can help people, I think it's incumbent upon us to do that. So, you know, good luck going forward. I'm really going to watch the ethicists, and I'm going to have more of them on my podcast because I think it's a fascinating area where our ability to create technology meets our ability to use it wisely. And I'm really excited by that.
Yep. Yep. Absolutely. Okay. Kevin, this I think is like, this is your thing, is talking about plant mutations. So tell us about Greenpeace and what they're trying to prove with this this next study we're going to talk about.
Oh, boy. Yeah, I really wanted to go back and look this up because I wanted to see who originally did the work. But, you know, Greenpeace basically funded a study that said we can detect gene-edited crops. And that's always been the issue is we, you know, for those of us in science who've been gene-editing crops and all the companies that are doing it, has been, well, gene editing is no different than normal breeding. So how do you ever detect it? And Greenpeace has funded some folks to say, yes, we can. We can figure that out. And so this is an article that was translated from German, but from originally written by Klaus Strottmann.
Yeah.
Yeah, in Agrar Heute, which is Agronomy Today in German, from last week. And this all keys off of a gene that's typically used in canola and something called Clearfield herbicide resistance. So Clearfield herbicide resistance is resistance to ALS inhibitors. So it's acetolactone synthase. It's an enzyme that's required in the first step of the biosynthetic pathway for hydrophobic amino or nonpolar amino acids. So leucine, isoleucine, valine, for those geeks out there, this is where ALS is important, the acetolactone synthase. And if you can disrupt that enzyme with different compounds, which they've done, they're called imidazolinone herbicides, they stop that enzyme from working. What they found is that there are certain natural mutations that can occur in ALS enzymes that make them resistant to the herbicide. And so this is what they call Clearfield. And they're naturally occurring. You just mutagenize canola, put out acres and acres and acres of it, and then spray it with these herbicides and then look to see who survives. And so there's Clearfield canola, there's Clearfield rice, there's Clearfield sunflowers. So many different plants are in this Clearfield category. And they're not GMOs, right? Nobody's inserted a gene. You just put chemicals on that scrambled things and they grew through it. And then so that's the magic here. Well, because we know it works, scientists can also target acetolactone synthase and do that using CRISPR-Cas9. And that's been done. And so different groups have now taken elite varieties of canola and gone ahead and made that same change. They've made that same deletion in acetolactone synthase, acetolactate synthase. They've made that same mutation and shown that you can make this herbicide-resistant canola. Well, Greenpeace says, well, now we can go ahead and detect that. And so it's not such an not such a great technology because it's not just traditional breeding. We can find it. And that was what the big push of the paper was.
Okay. And just so that's clear to everybody, that's been the hang up ever since gene editing was first introduced for uses in agriculture. Because people like you, Kevin, have said this is, it's just another way to introduce a mutation into the genome of a crop. There's nothing really untoward here. There's no foreign quote unquote DNA. But for groups like Greenpeace who want to regulate this as if it is just another, I think they will sometimes refer to this as GMO 2.0, because they want to regulate this as if it's a genetically modified crop. They need to be able to have data like this, even if it is spurious. They have to be able to say, no, 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 we can detect this. Even if it doesn't really prove anything in terms of the safety, they just need this so they can push the regulations they want. Is that correct?
Oh, that's exactly right. Their goal is to be able to say that, well, this isn't so special that you can't find it. And unfortunately, that's not true. You cannot detect between the installed change and one that is done by natural breeding. And this was the outcome as based by German regulators, and that's where all of this really went down, where the discussion took place. And the BVL office, which is the Bundesamt für Verbraucherschutz und Lebensmittelsicherheit.
Sehr gut.
That's the Federal Office for Consumer Protection and Food Safety. They say there's no big deal here. There's nothing to be had here. That all of the, as they say, the oilseed rape is a safe product that is not any different than what could be happening by random genetic changes through traditional breeding.
Now, if and this is the ironic part to me, and again, correct me if I'm wrong, if they really wanted to say something was edited with CRISPR, wouldn't they have to insert some kind of a biomarker while they were doing this in order to say, oh yeah, look, now we know it was gene edited because we tagged it that way. is that possible? And I think you would have to do something like that, right? If you wanted to somehow distinguish one plant from the other.
Well, that's true. You would have to install some sort of DNA sequence that would be detectable. And really what's happening here is a deletion in the ALS gene that is already well established and already works. So you can't tell the difference between the mutation you make and the one that was made by dousing a plant in chemicals, you know, or soaking seeds and, you know, stuff called EMS. there's chemicals that damage DNA that you can use, and they're not GMO. I mean, nobody really cares. You can use those to induce genetic variation. And that's what they did to create the first generation of Clearfield crops. So here they were able to do this not with chemicals that just damage the whole genome, but with a very focused laser, essentially, that surgically changed that one gene in a way that would make it immune to the herbicide. There's no difference between that technique and the other technique of chemically inducing it, except for it takes a whole lot less time and is much more directed.
Gotcha. Well, now you guys have a little bit of ammunition if someone brings this up. tell us about Talking Biotech, Kevin. What's the latest over there?
Well, this week in Talking Biotech, we're going to talk about sepsis. And the problem of sepsis is a real problem because following surgeries, following other types of interventions, bloodborne disease is a huge issue, especially in the developing world. And I spoke with the CEO of a company that's developed tests to rapidly determine what is the pathogen that needs to be treated. The big problem with sepsis is you don't know who's in there. And so they throw the kitchen sink at somebody to try to cure the problems they have, and you end up breeding more antibacterial or bacterial resistance. So this way you're able to provide the exact antifungal, antibacterial that best does the job. So really cool technology, and we'll talk about that this week.
Very, very cool stuff. Go check it out. And check us out on Twitter if you want to interact, at CamJEnglish, at Kevin Folta, and geneticliteracyproject.org. We will see you next time.